Hi, this is John Takis, writer and album producer, and you are listening to the Geekcast Radio Network.
Amen. Amen. Amen.
Hello and welcome to the Powers of Grayskull podcast. I am TFG1 Mike. Optimus Soul is not joining me this time around, but folks, we have spent 3 years here on the Powers of Grayskull covering Tales of Eternia. We spent 3 years, 45 episodes, covering all 130 episodes in depth of He-Man and the Masters of the Universe. We just released about a week ago our He-Man and She-Ra Secret of the Sword commentary. I do have plans to bring you guys more interviews in our brief hiatus before we start our She-Ra coverage coming up in September. Tonight is one of those times. I am talking with album producer extraordinaire, Mr. John Takis. Hello, sir.
Hello. Good to be here.
How are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
So the reason why John is back, and this is actually his first time on the He-Man show, but this is his second time on the GCRN. We had talked to John back, I talked to you back in October of 2014 when the Batman the Animated Series Volume 3 came out.
Yes.
Well, John has entered Eternia, folks. He has painstakingly, and we will go over some of this in very much great detail tonight, gone through and given us through for La La Land Records a 2-disc release for He-Man and the Masters of the Universe, the classic Filmation cartoon series. 111 tracks. I just,
it's, I'm staggered.
The mind boggles. Yeah, I mean, because I'm always one of those people that, because I have been dealing with La La Land Records for 2 years now on written reviews, and I also do certain audio things for them as well. I actually just interviewed Matt and Michael, was it the end of last year for the first time? So, you know, I'm used to seeing their 2, 3, 4, 6, 10, you know, I'm used to seeing these multi-disc releases from them. And what always boggles my mind is how much you guys can get on, whether it's just 2 discs or 4 discs or whatever. And with this release, it kind of surprised me because of the way that it's laid out. The first disc is it's 53 tracks overall. But the first 11 are referred to as the album.
The
I will ask you about that in a moment. But, you know, you got 53 tracks on disc one, and most of those tracks are pretty much what we've heard, what we hear throughout the cartoon series, like the Save the Day theme, like the Goodbye Orko theme. Let's see here. The Battle in the Sky theme. I always remember what is called the Battle in the Sky theme, the track 18 on disc one, because that's the music that they always play when a Wind Raider or a Sky Sled or whatever vehicle Skeletor had for that week, you know, the Rotom or whatever.
Yeah.
I always remember that one. So how did you, did La La Land approach you and say, hey, we want you to be the one to do this, to get this together? How did it go about you working on this release?
Sure. Well, I'll start out with a little context, just, you know, so your listeners don't get a too high opinion of me. I am a co-producer on this release.
Okay.
I have to give great props to, first of all, to MV Gerhard and Matt Verboys, who are the heads of the label and the executive producers. Their diligence is what allowed us to put this together in being able to do a premiere release of the original tracks from the original tapes, first generation tapes. They spent a long time searching for this material, and they found it. And then I co-produced the album with Neil S. Bulk, who did a tremendous job sorting through this material, coming up with a sequence. Thanks to our associate album producer and art director, Dan Goldwasser, for doing a spectacular job. And a very special thanks to Johnny D. Davis, Stephen Marsh and Fernando Lee, who handled the transfers and the mastering, and all these credits are in the booklet, but just, you know, we really benefited from a lot of skilled hands on this and making it the best album it could be. Now, a little context. This album has been in the works for years. Mm-hmm. It's been literally years. And so that's actually when I was approached. It was I think a little over 2 years ago. It was before that big boxed set with the DVD set in the shape of Castle mm-hmm. Grayskull. You know, it had the classic series and the new series.
The Mill Creek release.
Yeah, that giant Mill Creek release. It was even before that. You know, that they wanted to do something, and that came with a CD containing some of the old album material, of course. So yeah, they said, hey, do you like He-Man? Do you like Masters of the Universe? And I said, yeah, of course. You know, a child of the '80s, that was so I was not a super fan as a child. I was a little young when it first started airing, and you know, my parents were among those who were not all that into me watching violent cartoons. and I've said, you know, one of the great things about going back and revisiting the series after all these years is just how whimsically innocent it all seems on the spectrum. You know, it's tough to get yourself in that headspace where people thought that He-Man was just, you know, violence unleashed. But yeah, it was a part of my childhood, as many Filmation shows and animation shows of that era were. And so I was excited about the chance to go back and revisit it. And even if you didn't watch the show, as you well know, even if you didn't watch the show regularly, He-Man was unavoidable. It was inescapable. The merchandise was everywhere. The action figures were everywhere. I got hand-me-down action figures from my cousins. The action figures were at my kindergarten. So, you know, you could not get away from He-Man. It was a huge, huge phenomenon. It took a couple years once I was approached for everything to come together. We weren't sure what we'd find. And then within the last year, it just kind of all, you know, kind of came to a head. We found the materials. We got them transferred. We got them sorted. And the results of that are now available to buy. So,
yeah, I mean, you know, I was 3 years old when the show premiered. So I watched it when I was, you know, 86, 87, when I was 7, 8 years old. So, I mean, a lot of the He-Man stuff, and I've said this on the podcast before, a lot of the He-Man stuff I had watched later, somewhere between ages 6 and 10. So,
yeah
I wasn't even really, like when it first debuted, I had no clue. I think it wasn't until maybe 86 that I even knew about Secret of the Sword.
Yeah. Well, we were the kind of the first generation where He-Man was kind of always on our radar, you know.
Because of that first run syndication deal that Scheimer had, and
absolutely,
and you know, like you said, it was besides the toys, the cartoon was everywhere. I mean, you couldn't turn on a cartoon, you couldn't turn on a TV on a weekday or a Saturday morning without seeing at least 1, 2, or 3 different episodes of He-Man throughout the day.
Yeah. Yeah, it was a tremendous success. I mean, the syndication thing, again, it was considered a big risk at the time, but boy did it prove the naysayers wrong.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Now, the process of finding the materials, and I know it's in the booklet, but for everybody listening, walk us through, because I have you here. I might as well just have you tell the story. I'm not going to sit here and have you listen to me read through what you wrote.
There's not that much to tell about the finding of the materials. Which first of all, it kind of happened in between when I was contacted and then when I was brought back on. So I was not actually involved with the great master tape hunt. I believe the source was in England. And they sent a list of what they had, and Neil looked at that and said, okay, we need this and this. and they sent it over. And it's I guess you'd have to ask MV or Matt if there's more of a story there. But I've been told it's a pretty simple story of we found a guy, you know. So, yeah.
See, I remember as a kid. My memory is so fuzzy on this because it was at a time when I was with my best childhood friend at the time, which, God, I haven't seen him in, it's been over 20 years now. But anyway, it's one of those things where he had an old LP, and I don't know if it was one of the story LPs or which LP it was, and I've been trying to search online for Masters of the Universe LPs and to see if I remember, because I remember what the cover, the album art looks like. I remember all that. I just don't remember what was actually on the album. And I think it was one of those old story LPs.
It almost certainly was, because odds are that your friend was not connected enough to have an import from one of the regions. I mean, maybe he was. I don't know your friend, but
no, we were 8, 9, 10 years old. There's no way.
In America, most kids had to content themselves with story albums. It was only in some of the as Spanish speaking Latin American regions, and then in Europe there was a French LP. There were only a few that had actual underscore music tracks on them. Now, of course, you listening to the story had music and sound effects playing along, so you know it was all part of it. But isolated music was really only confined to territories outside the United States.
Yeah. So when you guys got all the material together and you went through to assemble it, what was the decision making in making the first 11 on disc one from the album and then the rest of them?
Well, basically we had an independent source for that, and those tracks are stereo, with the exception of the very first one, because the album that we retrieved and did a very painstaking transfer from vinyl was was the Spanish album. And the first track on that album was the version of the theme song that has vocals, Spanish lyrics to it. As much as we love that, we preferred that as a bonus track, and to have the broadcast length version of the theme, the more familiar version of the theme, to kick off the whole set. So we opened disc one with that, but then we wanted to present that original album because that's the way it was originally presented to those fans who were lucky enough to have it, and because those tracks are stereo, and so they have kind of a different sound field. The mono tracks sound great, don't get me wrong. Mono tracks sound fantastic, and they're from original quarter-inch tapes, whereas the stereo album is merely a very professionally done vinyl transfer, because whatever stereo tapes originally existed for that album, we were unable to be found. But really, I mean, I just keep coming back to what a miracle it is that this stuff was found at all, given how long and persistently it was believed to be lost. But to answer your question, that's basically why. We had the stereo tracks, it was the original album sequence, and we wanted to kind of honor that. And it's a good listen. It's a short listen. It's a good listen. And then we move into the brand new, newly discovered, newly released stuff from the show.
Yeah. Stuff like He-Man at Home, He-Man Trapped, Prince Adam and Teela.
He-Man in Space, He-Man in the Country.
He-Man in the Country, that's a funny track.
It is.
That's a funny track, because it's one of those ones where as soon as I hear it, I know what scene it's supposed to be in. It's supposed to be in any scene when Adam is either fishing or he's doing his lazy stuff.
Yeah.
And Teela's in the background just nagging at him like the nagging bee that she is.
Oh, come now, that's harsh.
I'm telling you, if you go back and you listen to any of the 44 previous episodes of this show, Teela is my least favorite character in this entire series. I've spent 3 years watching this girl, and she makes absolutely horrible decisions. And oh my, I don't want
to look. Someone has to make horrible decisions, or the plot's not going to happen.
That's true. but He-Man and the Country. As soon as I heard it, I'm like, yeah, that's not the country songs I grew up. Like, I can't picture, and I live in the state. I can't picture, you know, BFE Kentucky with all these horse farms and farmlands and tobacco. Like, that's not a country song to me, but I get it. I understand why it's called that and why it sounds the way it does. Is because it's supposed to give you a sense of relaxation. It's not a battle theme. It's more of, hey, let's go be lazy.
Well, that's the whole point of this music is to take you to some place, you know, weird and wonderful and special. The way that the music, one of the great things that the music for the show did, was it created a really, unique atmosphere. And it really helped make Eternia feel like this wild and alien place, and that's a big part of the fun of the show, I think, was getting to go so far outside of the normal.
Absolutely, you know, tracks like Facing the Castle and which is track 5, and then The Castle is track 8, you know, so you guess Castle Grayskull themes. And then you have the Snake Mountain theme, which I'm trying to look here. What track is that? Someone said to me on Twitter, I think it was Grimbot, who is one of the people over on the He-Man.org forum, said something about you speculated that might be a demo track.
Oh, there's something. We encountered some tracks on here that actually sound more polished than what was used in the series.
Okay.
Which is to say that instead of this kind of very kind of, you know, artificial sounding fakey brass, there are a few tracks that we were able to uncover that have a much more realistic live brass sound. You know, again, I'm sure that not even the composers might remember why and how this was done. So I don't want to say that the ones that were used in the show were demos. They're a little rougher from a musical standpoint, in that they're not, you know, they're a little more synthy, a little less live instruments. And so it was apparent to us that some of these cues were simply done twice. And we had some of the versions that didn't wind up getting used in the series. That we know of. I always want to be careful.
Mm-hmm.
When we're talking 130 episodes, plus all the episodes, 90 some, whatever it is, of She-Ra.
93, yeah.
I don't want to say about any of these tracks that, well, this track wasn't used in the series, because I know that the second I do that, you know, some He-Man super fan such as yourself will say, ah, no, in 120 on the transition, you know, back to the castle, there you hear 5 seconds of this cue. And that, so I want to be very careful saying that any particular cue is not used in the series at all. I will leave that to people who are more dedicated scholars than myself. That said, I think I was surprised by the amount of material on here that felt new to me, that I didn't instantly recognize from the show. And I wouldn't be surprised if some of this wasn't used. I know certainly that because we have complete pieces, there are themes that were used in the show, even used many times, but they may have been used piecemeal. You know, they may have used a couple, you know, a minute of it here, a minute of it there, but they never put it all together. So you're hearing here the tracks as they were recorded. So that's pretty cool. The other thing is that there are tracks on here that the titles, because we found original track titles for this. They're read out on the tapes. And what's very interesting to me is that the way they were titled reflects probably the request that was given to the composer that says, okay, we need music for this, this, and that. We need music for, you know, here's a picture of Beast Man with some skulls. So you get a cue called Beast Man and Skulls. But from watching the show in context, the way that cue would have been used, you would never necessarily guess that it was called Beast Man and Skulls, because this was all library music and they picked and chose what they wanted and used it how they wanted it. So I think it'll be very interesting to fans to compare these track lists. You know, there were some surprises for me. I imagine there'll be some surprises for everyone who goes through this with a real good knowledge of the series.
What really surprised me is not necessarily the body of the music that's on here, but some of the things that I never thought we'd ever get a actual track of. Like the title card stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
The title card themes are, even though they're only like 11, some of them are only 11 seconds, and they're really, you know, it's so nice to have something like that, because...
Well, sure. How many times did you hear those title cards watching the series? You know, they only had a handful of them, and they cycled through them. It's great to have that. I mean, it was on there. There's no way we were going to leave that off. Yeah.
Now, I'm curious about this because it lists it as, and I think it lists it as this on the track listing in the booklet. Track 81, Singing Crystal, it lists it as a remix. What's that all about?
That's how it was identified on the tape.
Okay.
That's basically it. It's not a remix in the sense, you know, we gave it to a popular artist to do a cover. If I had to guess, I'd say because there are layers to that piece, you know, it might have been recorded and, you know, there might be an earlier version that's stripped down, maybe doesn't have the singing part of it. That's just a guess, though. It's the only version of that cue we had. It was marked as remix. I think it's the same as you hear in the actual episode. That's one case where it is from exactly the episode you think it's from. There's only one episode with a singing crystal as
exactly.
Yeah.
And then there are six alternate ending tracks.
Mm-hmm.
And there are six mono tracks.
Yeah, mono mixes of tracks that were on the original album. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. I think, honestly, the only one that I had to actually take off my iTunes playlist is the Spanish theme.
Didn't get into the spirit of it, huh?
It just doesn't. And see, that's the other thing. You guys don't have... And I understand why it's not here, and I don't blame anybody for this. When I saw He-Man main theme, which is the very first track, I thought it was going to be that traditional Prince Adam comes in.
Oh yeah, yeah. I am Prince of Eternity.
And I'm like,
yada, yada, yada.
And I'm like yeah. And I'm like, okay, so it's not that. It's just the instrumental and the vocal, which is fine. I don't have a problem with that. And then I realized, oh, wait, it's not on here at all. That's interesting.
Well, that wasn't on the tapes. We would have to take that directly from the DVDs, which
that's true.
We already have.
Yeah.
So.
That's interesting. I wonder why it wasn't on the tapes.
Well, because this is from the recording sessions. They I'm sure they didn't add the dialogue until the first dubbing sessions. I don't think he was, you know, there in the studio, you know, doing the narration along with the orchestra. If he was, it was not on the tapes that we found.
I know this is going to be hard for you, but can you pick your top three favorite tracks?
Oh, sure. I'll take a stab at it. Okay. I tell you one I really like. I really like the one called "Good Guys" on disc 2, track 26. It's long. It's 2 minutes and 30 seconds, and it has this great big climactic feeling. I like that track an awful lot. Gosh, let's see. I like. One that someone put me onto, I think it's Journey to the Unknown Planet.
Yeah.
Which is this kind of funky, you know, almost techno feel to it. Someone asked me about that cue before the album came out. They were anxious that it be on there. It was from that She-Ra episode where she and Hordak are kind of like plunging through dimensions together. And they said, you know, I think that's from He-Man, because even though it's She-Ra and Hordak, you know, the music is going da-da, da-da, you know, it's doing the He-Man theme. So, yeah, that's a good one. Let's see. I'm going to go with Orko Means Well. I need to get a good Orko track on there. You got to love Orko's theme.
And he's probably the one character that has... many variations on his theme.
Yeah, him and Teela, and of course He-Man got a lot. Oh, and Desolation, the track called Desolation. That you heard that plays so many times in the series. But it for a reason. It's a very, very evocative cue. So that's another favorite.
What is the deal with track? Well, it's overall track 65. Video game
Which
sting.
Is that video game sting.
It's 12 seconds, and I don't know if it was supposed to be a game track or if it was supposed to be from the series itself. I don't think it was.
Is that from? It's the episode with the guy who puts them into a video game.
The game master. Game plan, that could, that could be
that's it.
Yeah, that could be it.
I'd have to go back and look. Like I said, you know, you marathon a 120 or 130 of these episodes, and they can tend to blur together a little bit. I couldn't tell you off the top of my head if that cue was used in that episode, but it's probably written for that episode.
Yeah. What was the most interesting thing about working on this project for you?
The most interesting thing. The most interesting thing for me was getting to go back and revisit this series as an adult and as a student of animation history. You know, I certainly, you know, was exposed to the show, had good memories of the show. But I wasn't like a real super He-Man fanboy. I didn't run out and get all the DVDs and you know, it's not like, you know, something with Batman, which I was totally obsessed over. So getting to go back and watch the show kind of with fresh eyes, it was very interesting to me to see elements from those kind of people who worked on the show who would later go on to become big names in the entertainment industry, or big names, at least in our circles. So, you know, you had Straczynski, who worked on this show. You had Bruce Timm and Paul Dini, who worked on this show before they did Batman, the animated series. And the whole trend of making an animated series for syndication, which was virtually, you know, unheard of before this. That's another thing that kind of became an industry, normal industry practice. I'd be going through and I'd say, oh, here's a Dini scripted episode. And it was interesting because you can see kind of his fingerprints there, which is something I never would have picked up on as a kid. But now going back and say, yeah, these are some of the story themes and the character types that, you know, concern him as an artist. So it was just interesting to connect, you know, A to B to C. It was interesting to see the things that were happening on this show that were both kind of reflect where Filmation had come from and where some of these artists and creators would go on to create, because they put so many resources into this. They really had all hands on deck. They had the old guard, but they had, you know, younger, you know, talent eager to prove themselves. And that was interesting. It was very interesting to me. And then the other thing I think was just, I think how well it holds up as a trip down memory lane, as a listening experience. When we watch the series, there's so much tracked music and so much library music that it's easy to kind of slip into the mentality that you're just hearing kind of the same handful of tracks over and over again. And in some cases you were. They certainly favored some cues rather than others. Having it on disc like this, though, without that repetition, gives you a much better idea of the full scope of the show and the different places that it could go and, you know, how diverse and interesting the music stays. I was thinking, like, gosh, you know, what's going to be like to sit down and listen to two CDs of this? And I, you know, ate it up quite happily, so.
Yeah. I spent, after, you know, Matt sent me the review copy, I spent maybe 4 days listening, writing, because the way I have to do some of my written reviews is sometimes I go track by track, but obviously on a release that's 111 tracks, I can't sit here and talk about all 111 of them.
That is also why there is not a track by track analysis.
Yeah, no.
The book would have been 60 pages, an extra 60 pages or something. Yeah.
And honestly, there are some cues on here that just don't catch my ear. Not that I dislike them, but there are some where it's like, okay, what's next? you know.
Well, sure, I mean, you know, you're not with a disc that's so diverse with so many tracks. Yeah, you're going to have your favorites and ones that don't catch you as much. But I think what's nice is that there's kind of something for everyone on here. I know this. It's a cliche thing to say, but this has something for everyone. It really is true.
And it is really, really awesome. They have done an amazing job putting. You guys have just done so well putting this together.
Thank you.
So where do you guys go from here? And I know that's more of a label question than for you, but like the next. Now I've seen fans.
I tell you where we go from here. Where we go from here is giving the same answer to approximately 12,000. When are you going to do She-Ra?
Right.
And you know, God bless the fans. We love all this stuff too. That's the bottom line. You know, we love this. We are kind of that generation too. You know, we came of age with this stuff. It's not a lack of will to make it.
Right. Well, yeah, it has to be the right conditions, the right time, the right
the world,
deal.
The right materials. You have to find the materials. The legal framework has to be in place, as you say. You got to make the deal. And then you actually have to produce the set, which, you know, it can take years. I mean, where we go from here is where we've always gone, which is, you know, onto the next cool project to release. And I certainly hope that the stars align and we're able to give people everything that they want. You know, I hope we're able to do She-Ra. I hope we're able to do all of that. Unfortunately, I don't get to decide, you know.
Right.
And in some cases, Matt and MV don't get to decide because sometimes it just can't happen for a variety of reasons. I not to discourage, you know, people, but just as a warning to anyone who asks, you're probably going to get the same answer, which is we love this stuff. We'd love to see it happen. We can't promise you it'll happen on, you know, at X date. All I can say is that, you know, we love this stuff and, you know, we love being able to get it out there. So.
Now, my assumption, and I know what happens when people make assumptions, but my assumption is they've already found all the She-Ra stuff and it's going to be out before the end of the 30th year, which is this year, since She-Ra came out 30 years ago this year. That would be awesome. I know it probably won't happen, but that's my assumption. Mm. That the work's already being, it's already started. What other projects do you have coming up, or what other things can you talk about that you're working on?
What can I talk about? That's the answer is not much. One of the nice things about He-Man was that MV had kind of been saying for years that he was going to release it, so it wasn't like a huge secret that one was coming. I mean. Without giving too much away, I think that from La La Land, you know, you're going to see them pursue many of the kinds of projects that they've been pursuing. I think you're going to see more stuff Star Trek related. I think you're going to see more stuff with the DC animated properties, which is first to the gate. You know, what gets greenlit sooner than the others? How long do they take to produce? I can't comment on any specific release.
Right.
But I think if you're a fan of animation or science fiction or Star Trek or superheroes, I think that we're going to try and keep these next few years as exciting as the last few years have been. So,
absolutely, absolutely. Do you have, if you can remember, do you have a favorite episode of He-Man and the Masters of the Universe?
Oh, gosh.
There's only 130 to choose from.
There's only 130. I'm going to say anything with Granamir in it.
That's a good answer. We love Granamir.
I love Granamir. He's weird and wonderful. I mean, a lot of my choices, I'm sure, are going to be you know, cliches because they're fan favorites. So, things like the the problem with power. Yeah, that's a nice cliche one to mark down as a favorite, I'm sure. I like Granamir, I think, just because he's such a wonderfully kind of unexpected type of character. You know, he's such a unique character. He's not your stereotypical dragon in a fantasy story. He's got that weird helmet, and he's kind of, you know, not really aligned with the heroes. He's not a villain, but he's kind of in that gray area. So yeah, anything with Grandemere I enjoy quite a bit. I like the one where He-Man, Prince Adam No More,
yep,
where he decides that he needs to prove himself to his father by giving up. And that's a Paul Dini script, too. So, you know, Paul Dini, I think even back then on this show, like to kind of dig more into what made the characters tick, what made their psychology, work. So, yeah, that's another good one. There was the really early Teela's Quest. I know you're not a Teela fan, but I like that.
That is the one episode, I think probably the only Teela episode, I gave it above a 3 on a 5 scale rating.
That's another Dini script, too.
Yeah. I think that's probably why, because it was Dini.
He's always been good with strong, female characters, and, as we saw, of course, with Harley Quinn. But, yeah, so those are a couple of my favorites. It's and I find the Secret of the Sword, not the Secret of the Sword, the Christmas special, That is, I find that to be just a pure hilarious joy. When the puppy licks Skeletor's face, and oh my gosh, and the little shoehorned in robot aliens that we've never seen before, that I have a suspicion was intended as a test pilot for a possible new spinoff. The way they were kind of shoehorned in there, I thought was, I find it absolutely delightful. It's wonderful holiday viewing.
I would take that over the Star Wars Christmas special.
Oh, absolutely. But now let me ask you this. Have you actually watched the Star Wars holiday special from beginning to end?
No, I can safely say I have never seen the Star Wars holiday special, but go ahead, John. What are you gonna say?
I say they ought to give out merit badges for that. That's such
I can safely say I've never seen it, but I've heard people review it on podcasts, and it's
no review you've ever read can prepare you. Star Wars holiday special. You may think you know what you're getting into. It's much easier. It's much more of a chore to get through. But I have a lot of affection for the He-Man version, that's certainly a high point. Just in terms of having fun with it,
At some point, I don't think it'll be this Christmas, folks, but I think it'll be Christmas 2016 in the Powers of Grayskull schedule, because this podcast is going to be 125 episodes. Ooh. So, and this is just for your information, because everybody else knows this by now, but this podcast is going to be 125 episodes, and I believe it's episode 75.5 is when we're going to be doing the Christmas special, but most likely that won't happen. That won't air until Christmas 2016, because we haven't even started production on the Shiver reviews yet. Like I said, we just finished the Secret of the Sword stuff, and I remember seeing the Christmas special as a kid, but I don't, that was so long ago. I don't even remember it. And with the Star Wars Christmas, the holiday special, it's like someone says, "Oh, it's all in Wookiee." If it's not in English, I don't watch it. Don't get me wrong.
Yes and no. There are quite a few scenes with the Wookiees that are unsubtitled. But I'd say in the grand scheme of things, that's probably a mercy.
It's one of those things where, and don't get me wrong, I can watch stuff that has subtitles that, if there's, I've been watching the Marvel Daredevil show that's on Netflix now. And, there's the Yakuza gang, there's the Russian gang that speak Russian and Japanese, whatever else. That's all well and good. But if something is entirely in a different language other than English, it's probably something I'm going to avoid because I just can't sit here and read. When I want to watch something for enjoyment, I want to actually watch it and understand the whole thing. I don't want to, and I'm sure someone will say, oh, well, why don't you go get, you know, Rosetta or whatever the hell language learning program.
Just learn Japanese. How yeah. hard can it be?
Yeah, really.
Well, I as a fan, as a major fan of foreign films, and I'm very used to subtitles at this point. So, I think with the case of the Star Wars Holiday Special, well, it's like in the Star Wars movies, Chewbacca's never subtitled. You know, you always know what's going on.
That's because you have the expositionary characters around him. Like,
there are expositionary characters in the Star Wars Holiday Special too.
Yeah.
Again, I say you may regret that at some point. Mm-hmm. But it's mostly third, you know, what kind of washed up stars, you know, TV stars and short little cameo appearances from the main Star Wars cast. So give it a shot. Get together with some friends, have some, you know, intoxicating beverages on hand, and you'll be fine.
Take a drink every time Chewie shows up.
No, don't do that.
I know.
You won't make it.
I know. All right, folks. You can get the He-Man Masters of the Universe music from the television series, 2-disc set from La La Land Records. It's lalalandrecords.com. I do want to bring this up. I know they're addressing it. I know they have addressed it, or they will be addressing it, because this interview actually won't be out until a week after we recorded it. But there was a problem with the plant that La La Land uses, and some people were getting CDR pressings.
Yeah, there was a repressing, which doesn't... I'm not sure if it was... people have to remember that when a limited edition release like this comes out, you know, 3,000 copies, they don't print all 3,000 at once. It's done in stages based on the demand. It's done in batches. And one batch came through, and it wasn't the first one, you know. And La La Land sends these out sealed from the factories. When you buy from La La Land, you get a factory-sealed disc. So, yeah, it wasn't until people started reporting that they realized the issue. But La La Land is addressing the issue, and any of your listeners who happen to get one of those discs can write to the contact information on their website, and they will take good care of you.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, folks, that's going to do it for us. Like I said at the beginning of this one, I do have plans for Optimus Solo and I to get interviews with other voice actors from He-Man Masters Universe. We're hopefully going to get Skeletor, hopefully going to get He-Man himself, maybe. So we do have plans to keep the content going between now and our hiatus, but our next series up is we're entitling our next section of the podcast Myths of Etheria, and we're going to be talking about all 93 episodes of She-Ra. So that's what's going on there. Yeah. I'm one of those people where podcasting for me is I have to go in depth. If I don't go in depth, I don't feel like I've done the listenership, you know, I don't think I've done them a proper service. In the 6 years that the network has been, the Geekcaster network has been online, we've done 3 Transformers podcasts, a mask podcast, and it's a whole thing. So, but yeah, up next is going to be our She-Ra coverage coming in September, and we cannot wait. We are excited. I will be the first to admit, and people know listening, at the end of He-Man season 2, I was burnt out. I never wanted to watch a He-Man episode ever again. Oh, my God. All right, folks. John, where can they get a hold of you online? Twitter, your website, whatever you want to give out.
Oh, yeah. You can find me online at johntakis.com. That's johntakis.com. I don't update with blog posts nearly as much as I should, but there's usually a roster of my current projects on the left sidebar, and my email is there. And you can also find me on Facebook and Twitter without, I don't think I'm too hard to find. At Twitter, I think I'm just at John Takis. So,
okay. Awesome. All right, folks. By the power and for the honor of Grayskull, we will catch you next time.
He-Man!